Thanks. My name is Phil Cusick. I cover telecom and cable here at JP Morgan. And I'm happy to welcome Ralph Del Vega. Ralph's the vice chairman of AT&T. And, you know, Ralph, thanks for joining us. I've been thinking about, you met probably a lot of people in the room, and we sort of went through a little bit this last night, but given that AT&T is so big and you've changed your portfolio quite a bit, can you talk about what you've been up to lately and where your main focuses are?
Sure, but before I start, let me give you the obligatory safe harbor statement, which says that some of my comments may contain forward-looking statements which are subject to risk, and results may differ materially. And if you have any questions, look at our SEC filings and the AT&T website. And Phil, one other thing today, because we're in the quiet period of the SEC incentive auction, that's a topic that I can't discuss.
Of course.
Okay. So what have we been up to? We have been in the process of implementing what I think is one of the most significant transformations I have ever been a part of when it comes to networking, particularly in the enterprise space and in the network space. We have been developing our software-defined networks in a way that we're now forecasting that by the end of this year, 30% of our network functions will be virtualized. And by 2020, it'll be 75%. So we're not talking about a small amount. We're really moving the network forward in virtualization. So when you say software-defined networking and virtualization, sometimes people get the two a little bit confused, and they're both software-based. But I wanted to explain to the investors how we view this at AT&T and what a difference this makes. When you have the capabilities for software to virtualize things, it dramatically changes the cost structure. It dramatically changes how you use the things. So many of you today probably use the virtual machine, but probably don't think you did. If you woke up this morning and use your smartphone to wake you up in the alarm function, that's a virtual function. They've taken an alarm clock that all of us used to travel with. It now runs as a piece of software on a piece of hardware. If you used to carry a flashlight with you, I no longer do. I used to when I traveled internationally, but that flashlight is also resident on my smartphone as a piece of software, not as another piece of hardware that you carry on. So what is happening in the network now is things that were done in hardware that required a physical piece of equipment, not unlike what I just gave you an example of, a clock or an alarm clock, that you would put in a shelf in a switching center, and you would have to hook up power to it, you would hook up connectivity to it, it would take up space, and many times you would stack one of those things on top of the other so you could have a router, a WAN accelerator, a Wi-Fi controller, a piece of software that provides security, all on top of another. All that information now is being provided with virtualization, which means I have one piece of hardware, and all the other services are software-based on top of that hardware. So instead of having four pieces of equipment and four connections, visualize one piece of equipment, one connection, and four pieces of software that define the routing function, the firewall function, the controller function, the acceleration function. So instead of having four pieces, it's one, and instead of having four connections, it's one, Phil. So the first thing I would say to you is when you put something in our network, as we're moving fast forward on it, we're virtualizing it, but we're significantly reducing the OPEX and the CAPEX that it takes to run that network. But the beautiful thing about it, from a marketing point of view, is the services that ride on top of this new architecture, not only do they cost less CAPEX and less OPEX, but they generate more revenue. Because now the software cycles to turn up a service are almost instantaneous. We just launched a software-defined service that we call Network on Demand, and it's launched across the entire country in a matter of weeks. So now when you buy our Network on Demand service, once we turn it up for a customer, that customer can change the bandwidth on that service almost instantaneously. If the customer has a 5 megabit per second circuit and they want to go to a 20, they go to the portal, they make a change, and in less than 90 seconds, the new service is provisioned. There is no need to call a salesperson. There's no need to order equipment. There's no need to set up another connection. It happens in 90 seconds. And what I love about it is my revenue cycle is 90 seconds. That's a pretty good deal when you can lower CapEx, OpEx, and shorten the revenue cycle for your business. So we have now turned up our network on demand. We have thousands of customers on it. And let me give you one other bit of information that really gets me excited about how we're running our business differently. As recently as a year and a half ago, this would not have been able to happen. I'm not going to give you the actual name of the service, but I will tell you that later this year, we're going to launch a service on that software-defined network that is going to hit 63 countries at the same time on the same day. You show me a way to do that with a physical network, and I would say the chances of you making that happen are very, very small. With the concept that we have going on, we now feel like we have really totally transformed our product set on business services to be software-defined, to be virtualized, and so that they can be provisioned on demand. On-demand services is the future, and as John Donovan has told you before, Phil, we will have the network functions virtualized so that about 70% or 75% by 2020 will all be virtual. This is the way I think the world is going, and the customer reception that we have received every time we've shown it to a CIO is, when can I get it? Because it makes so much sense to them.
So what's the pace of revenue growth in this segment?
Well, the way that...
How big is it of a portion of the business?
The complete portfolio is getting remade from the old TDM and what we started doing, IP services, to this being the platform. Mm-hmm. So we're moving all of our service to this on-demand platform over time. And what we're offering the customer now is a complete end-to-end solution. So if you think about the typical customer today, they have wired connections, they have wireless connections, they have mobile devices, they have services in the cloud, and they need to get all those things connected in a quick, efficient, and safe and secure manner. That's what this architecture does. We can go to a customer and give them a solution that's end-to-end, from the software that resides on those mobile devices to the virtual private network that connects their network, to our NetBond product that connects their network securely to their cloud provider of choice, and then giving them threat analytics over the entire network that helps them detect the threat the minute it happens so they can take mitigating actions to reduce the security issues. So we think we have a service here that is lower CapEx, lower OpEx, shorter revenue cycles, huge upside, it's more secure, and I think it's going to be in great demand. What we have seen in the wireline side is unprecedented in terms of the ramp-up of people deciding they're going to move from the old services to the new services. So I'm really excited about what that brings forth, Phil, just in the traditional wireline business that's now been transformed into a new state-of-the-art software-defined business.
So, again, how big is that as a portion of the overall company? Or the overall enterprise business?
We count that as part of the way to best look at it so that you can use the information that's already out there. This is part of our strategic services portfolio. And what you're going to see is all the future growth of strategic services being derived on that. So we turned in double-digit growth on strategic services in the first quarter. We've done it about 14 to 15% a year ago. And that's a reflection of the growth that we're seeing from strategic services compared to the overall business revenues that we have.
Okay. And can that revenue base grow over time?
Absolutely. The thing that I like about what we're doing here is that by making things that are software-defined and then adding to it two other components are absolutely key to helping meet the needs of today's CIOs, and that is we give them the capability to connect the things that they have that many times have not been connected to the Internet with our Internet of Things capability. And then we allow them to take all the data that the Internet of Things capabilities are providing them and have the knowledge to change their business process to help them run better processes and improve their company operations. And it may seem simple to you, but some companies are now realizing that as good as they've been running companies, they can be run better when you have almost instantaneous access to your company's operation, whether you're shipping a container across the ocean, whether you are designing cars And now the car that you're designing, you can get 24/7 information on how the components of that car are performing, where are they failing, what is the failure rate, such that I think in the future, I can't think of too many companies who will be able to compete effectively if they don't have real-time data and data analytics that the Internet of Things provides in combination with their complete company network.
Now, historically, new segments have been lower margin than older or legacy segments. And as that shift happens, it's been painful on margin. How do you think about that for the enterprise business?
We have been working really hard, Phil, to take the new services and make them as profitable as the old services. And so today they're not. There's a little differential, but if you look at the improvement that we made over the last year, we made a big jump in improving the profitability of those services. And I think it will continue until, my view, we will be equal or better. And the reason I say that is the new services, again, are software-defined. We made good profits on the old services, but that's on old technology. The new technology gives us a chance to operate our network better, to make better margins, and at the same time give our customers a better deal because everybody's costs are lowered when you implement the new architecture.
So if I look at sort of total business solutions revenue, that's roughly a flat business year over year. This has got to be a bigger and bigger portion every year.
Yes, we're about 33% to 34% right now of our total revenues are in what we call strategic service revenue. Right. So we're migrating from the old to the new. And our history shows that once you begin to have that be the majority of your revenues, then the growth curves also go up.
And you said 70% by 2020?
I said 70% of the network functions. I didn't say the revenues. But what I'm trying to say is we're close to 50. Mm-hmm. The closer we get to 50, the better we have a chance of the new revenues than surpassing the old. And that's the trajectory that we're on.
Good.
We've seen this movie before, and it works well when you have a new portfolio of products that customers are excited about that are actually better to sell, better to operate, and require less capital than your old products.
You mentioned NetBond a minute ago. Can you talk about what that is and how it is differentiated?
Yeah, look, this is another major trend that, quite frankly, is not going to change. The trend of companies and institutions moving data and applications to the cloud, I think, is not stoppable. As more and more of your devices are being brought into the enterprise itself begins to put the data not on the device because it's not secure there, put it in the cloud. And so what we have seen is an amazing growth in traffic to the cloud. So we knew that our customers wanted to get their connections to the cloud provider of choice. Rather than build our own cloud infrastructure, we connect the customer's network to the cloud provider of their choice. So we have built a custom connection that goes from our network to all the major cloud providers that is software-defined, that has 20 patents that we develop that it is based on, because it adjusts automatically based on the workload that gets sent to the cloud. So the customer doesn't have to increase their connection. It does it automatically as the workload moves to the cloud. And we've done deals now to connect the Amazon cloud, for example, the Microsoft Azure cloud, the IBM SoftLayer cloud. We have Box. We have Salesforce.com. We just have all the key cloud providers now, for the most part, bonded to our network. So if you're a customer and you say, Ralph, I love this software-defined network. I want network on demand. I want your IoT service. I want data analytics. And I want you to connect me to the Azure cloud. I can say, done. And it happens very, very quickly. One example that I like to use, Phil, so people can get a sense of how this happens. What we have to happen today is companies come to us with pieces of equipment that have never been connected to the Internet, but that need to be connected so they can get performance data on them. But in many cases, they were concerned about connecting key components of plants because they were afraid about their security. But we had a customer came in and says, can you connect this voltage drive to my cloud provider of choice, which in this case was the Microsoft Azure cloud? And they said, we're going to send our IT guys there for a few days to you guys figure it out. They sent those folks. We took them to the AT&T machine-to-machine foundry in Plano, Texas. In 3 hours, they were done. The next week, we got a contract. And the point there being is that the speed at which the business is turning now with software-defined capabilities on the cloud I've never ever seen before. So it's an exciting time when we look out to the future to be able to reverse some of the trends that we have seen in the enterprise space.
Okay. How do you carry that over into the small and medium-sized business space? We've talked about gigapower and building out to more buildings. Do you have that, does SDN sort of fall down into those customers as well?
Yeah. You know that through Project VIP, which ended about a year ago, we made a commitment to take fiber to about 1 million businesses. We've got that done. So we've got a million base of businesses that we have fiber either to the building or within 1,000 feet of the building, which makes AT&T the company in America that has most fiber connection to buildings in the country. But in addition to that, we've committed to the FCC as part of the DTV merger to take fiber to 12.5 million additional living units. And, of course, we will make that commitment. But if we pass a business along the way, we're going to make sure that we get fiber to that business. As we expand our cell sites with small cells or macro cells and we pass a building, we'll take fiber to that building. So at AT&T, we are an integrated services company, so we look holistically at the market, not just consumer, small business, and medium business, but to make sure that the tentacles of our network reach all of our key customers, no matter whether they're consumer, business, large, medium, small. And my experience now is that the mid-market reception to these services is even better than I thought, because even small firms, I was talking to some folks, including you last night, and I mentioned that we have a small cancer center. And just to give you an idea for how this works, they have 12 locations. They came to us because when their patients come in to do the MRIs and the diagnostics that are very heavy data with x-rays and MRIs, they need to send that data, and then their network was not big enough to be able to handle it. So they were delaying those records, getting to where they should have gotten, in many cases, by days. And they said, can you help? Well, of course, we gave them our network on demand, which says, essentially, if you have a patient that comes in and you need to send that data over, if you want to, you can just increase the bandwidth, and in 90 seconds you have it, you can send it. You can turn it down if you want, or you can keep it for a day or two, or however you want. It's under customer control. And that's a 12-location mid-market business that is raving about how this dramatically changed the way they run the enterprise and the way they provide health care to their patients, knowing that the minute those results are available, that their doctor can have them as opposed to, you know, the angst of waiting days. It's just a completely different experience. So just giving you that as an example for how we're seeing the marketplace change.
Okay. And so as you add SDN, you get to more buildings, both consumer and residential. It seems like owning that fiber, there's more and more uses of that fiber. You don't report wireless and wireline CapEx anymore, probably partly for this reason. But do you feel like you build out more fiber deeper and deeper into the network as we go forward?
Absolutely. The thing I love about the AT&T strategy, let me make sure I connect these points for you, is the scale that we have and the capability we have with the commitments that I talked about give us the capability to have the lowest cost to deliver a bit, whether we deliver it with fiber, with wireless, or any combination of those. When we bring in the DTV, now DTV gives us the same scale with content. So we have the lowest cost per unit, however you want to measure it, of delivering content. Lowest cost to deliver a bit, lowest cost to deliver the content. And then I just told you that if I do those two things with software-defined networks, I have a huge upside on generating revenue. So it's a really great position that I feel we're in, the best strategic position that I think the company has been in since I've been with the company. It's been a long time.
Okay. Let's switch gears to wireless a little bit. Some of us have been frustrated that AT&T has been losing some share in postpaid wireless. You know, first, can you talk about the, you know, what have you been losing and where have you been gaining? And second, it seems like there's an opportunity to go after the DirecTV customer base more aggressively. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so let me explain the strategy. You know, in business, as we just quit talking about business, it was an integrated offer. The integration of business, wireless with wireline. The same thing in the consumer side when we're trying to integrate our DTV products with our broadband and our wireless capabilities. And our approach has always been, we have, when you look at wireless by itself, In my view, the best base of wireless customers in the industry, because we're the ones who first launched the iPhone and got just an incredible set of great customers. And our emphasis has been at the top end of the market, great service, protect that base, and that's a very loyal base to us. It has very low churn, and we're going to continue to do things to give customers a reason to stay. You've seen our churn numbers. Our churn numbers in postpaid actually are just hovering around the 1% range, which is actually pretty good. In the lower end of the market, we compete with Cricket. Cricket is our prepaid product, and we compete with Cricket. The customers that we have been losing in postpaid are primarily feature phone customers whose average revenue per user averages about $35. By contrast, the Cricket customers that we have coming in the funnel average 41. So we're not counting those prepaid customers coming in to offset postpaid losses because they're categorized differently. But if you ask us, I really like the 41 for 35 trade-off despite all the other issues. And we're growing Cricket, as you know, to the tune of about 500,000 customers per quarter, which is very, very healthy. In fact, Cricket led the entire industry. But despite having said that, where I think we have the greatest cross-sell opportunity that any company has ever had because of the number of customers that have one of our services as AT&T, but not two or three. I'll give you an example. We have 15 million households now in the country that have DirecTV service but don't have AT&T mobility. That's just the way, when we bought the company, that's the way that the mixture. If you look at it and you assume that there's anywhere from two to three customers per household on the average in the U.S., that's 2 times 15, 30 to 45 million customers who are our customers. They're in our DTV home, if you want to call it that. We know their email address. We send them a bill every month. We have given them great service, what I think is the best TV service in the country now. I think there's a great opportunity for us to cross-sell their products. Now, let me explain one thing, because you and I were discussing this last night as well, Phil. The approach that we have taken before we bring those DTV customers and mobility customers together is we are committed to giving them a better experience. So we haven't launched a full frontal attack to try to acquire those customers until the processes and the back offices are good enough. Today, for example, because we were two different companies, if you were to set up a new service for a customer, you would have to dispatch an AT&T technician and a DirecTV technician. One would put the dish, the other one would put in broadband. That's crazy. We're going to go to one technician before the end of the year, for example. So now I give the customer better service. You only have to rely on one person. That's half the cost of sending somebody to do the install, and it's going to give the customer a great experience. And there's several other examples like that in the back office that I could give you. So you have not seen us completely take advantage of an opportunity because we want to do it when the customer gets a service. They say, wow, that's a great experience. All the research that we have done says when you can deliver multiple services to customers and give them a wow experience, the churn is better and their revenues are higher. And that's exactly what our focus is going to be. So that's kind of where we think the opportunity is in mobility. By the same token, we have 20 million mobility households that don't have DirecTV service. So the same is true as the other way. That's what I'm saying. It's a huge cross-sell opportunity, and we think if we just get a portion of that, it'll provide more growth than the entire postpaid industry has shown here recently. So that's what we have our eyes set on. That's why we believe that the integrated services company is the future, because all the research that we have done, never mind what you've seen in Europe and other places, what we have seen with our own Uverse products in region verifies that what I'm telling you, at least in the states that we operate, have confirmed.
I was thinking about this morning, and I'm surprised that in DirecTV households, AT&T Wireless would under-index, given that it's a high-end home and a lot of it is not in the sort of urban core where some of your smaller competitors.
Well, keep in mind that we have built the company over years, and there were times when we may not have had the best rural coverage. We now do, but right. These are customers that are longstanding customers, may have had the service right. For a number of years. We're now super. In fact, we've done many surveys that show that where customers we used to have a weak coverage, now we're the number one player because of the changes and the investments that we've made. We just got to tell the customers, let them sample the service, and give them a great experience.
And I would expect you've done. Have you done similar efforts with UVerse customers over the years? Do they? How long did it take to sort of drive mobility penetration into those UVerse subs?
It's not something that happens overnight. You just right. throw a switch and it happens, Phil. It's methodical, and we know we're going to have to wait it out because people change their providers, you know, sometimes reluctantly. But we can see that over time, you can see an increase in the revenues, and you can see an increase in the, or I should say a decrease in churn and increase in loyalty.
Okay. And do UVerse customers over-index today to AT&T and mobility?
Yes. Yeah. And what we have seen happen is if you have one service, you have a certain churn rate. You have two, it's a lower churn. If you have three, the rate for the customer with three services is lower than the one that has two and much lower than the one who has one. If you have four, you hit the magic button, and it's a good place to be.
Good. So, you know, along those lines, T-Mobile and Sprint talk a lot about improving their quality. You talk about improving the quality in rural areas. You know, what gives you confidence that you can maintain a quality lead over those smaller competitors?
So let me explain it this way and we'll try to connect the dots. One of the things that determines the criteria of how good a quality a network you have and also the cost efficiency of the network is your spectrum position. Do you have sufficient spectrum so you don't have to keep building cell sites to get the quality network that we need? We're kind of in a situation which is, again, the best situation I've ever seen in my years with the company because we now have a great dense network, Phil, but we also have 40 megahertz of fallow spectrum that includes the purchases that we made in the AWS 3 auction as well as our WCS spectrum. So that gives us great capability to expand coverage to fill any holes we have with 40 megahertz of great spectrum because of the densification factor. We'll begin to use our WCS spectrum at the end of this year and AWS in the 2017 or so time frame. So I think we'll be able to provide what we need to provide, not only with great quality, but with great cost, because if you had to do that with building cell sites, with the cost of the real estate and all the things you have to do today, our experience shows that you're better off doing it with the right spectrum purchase.
I would think that 40 megahertz of fallow spectrum is a big competitive advantage over your peers. Do you need that to be able to offer the unlimited wireless for DirecTV customers, things like that?
Well, we need it for not just that, but for the overall growth that we see coming. But 40 is a great deal of bandwidth that I think will get us for several years the capacity that we need. And with small cell technology and more reuse of the actual spectrum in a small cell world, I think we're in great shape. I think we're in terrific shape with a good combination of low band, mid band, and high band spectrum.
Okay. Ralph is also the CEO of the international business. And as you talk about these things, both on the fixed and the mobile side, of thinking about how those play into the Mexico business, do all these things eventually make it down to Mexico?
Yeah. As you know, we have bought two companies in Mexico. We're putting the networks together, unifying them as one, and we now cover 51 million POPs with 4G LTE in Mexico, 100 million in the not-too-distant future. So we're in the process of building cell sites, taking fiber to cell sites. We just finished doing that in all of Mexico City, by the way. And we don't put the AT&T brand on a property in Mexico unless it meets pretty strict criteria in terms of reliability and quality. And we just did that in all of Mexico City, which is a great achievement by our team in Mexico. And what we're planning to do is to use the same concept that we're using in the States, using software-defined capabilities to offer business services in Mexico. And we've already began to deploy some what we call AT&T integrated cloud nodes that allow us to provide those services in other locations rather than just in the U.S.
How strategic is Mexico over time to the U.S. business overall?
Well, it's such a beautiful contiguous piece of landscape that one of the things that we do, for example, we do a lot of sales to car manufacturers. We are by far the number one provider of car connectivity to car manufacturers in the U.S. But all those car manufacturers sell cars in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, big time. And so now we can say to those customers, because of the great roaming agreements we have in Canada, we can almost give you the same quality network when you take your car on the road or your customers get it, whether it's in Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, which makes it a really great continuous capability, not only for us, but for our customers. So Mexico, to us, is a great opportunity. It's a very stable country. The changes that were put in place to ensure there's fair and a level playing field competition were built into the constitution of the country. It wasn't just a law passed. Mexico actually changed the constitution to require a level playing field. We feel very good about the legal foundation. We feel really good about the marketplace. And we really feel good about the capability for us to continue to penetrate that market, because it's relatively early in its development compared to where we are in the States. So I think we can accelerate the development of wireless services, but also business services in Mexico. My idea and my vision is I will talk to any customer in America and tell them that in the not-too-distant future, if they want to put a plant or an office in Mexico, we'll give them the same level of service they do in the United States in Mexico.
Yeah. One quick final question. Do you imagine the same services drifting in further south into South America? How strategic is the South American business to the rest of the organization?
In the Latin American business, what we're focusing on now, Phil, is basically operating that businesses as well as we can expect, making sure that those businesses don't require cash influx from the U.S. And I just came back from Buenos Aires, met with our team in Argentina, and I feel really, really good that we have an opportunity to do exactly what we've asked them to do, to generate free cash flow, and at the same time either hold or grow their market share. So we feel like in Latin America, our focus right now is run the best business you can, and we'll look at alternative options. But job one is run a great business, deliver a free cash flow that's positive, and hold your market share, and they're showing that they can do every one of those. And look, if the situation in Brazil or Argentina get a little bit better with the FX rates, you know, we may be able to even do better than that.
Good. I think we're out of time.
Okay.
Thanks, Ralph.
Thank you, Phil.
Nice to see you. Mm-hmm.